Hello, and welcome to the Transcending CRM podcast, a show where we explore how the Salesforce ecosystem has impacted the career of fellow trailblazers and the businesses that have leveraged dynamic growth from the platform. This podcast is brought to you by Silverline. Silverline is a Salesforce digital transformation consultancy headquartered in New York City, specializing in financial services, media and entertainment, and the healthcare industries. I'm your host, JP Owens, Managing Director of Banking and Lending at Silverline. Unfortunately, today, my co-host, Elliot Spence, is not available, so we will be recording solo, but I'm excited to let everybody know we are joined today by Greg Thompson, Digital Transformation Executive Coach at nCino. Greg is a seasoned executive and change agent for high-growth companies employing new technologies or adapting to dynamic market conditions. Greg, welcome to the show today.
JP, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you today. I know this. We're almost on episode 40 here of the podcast, and In almost every episode, I feel like change management is a key theme we end up getting into, whether we're talking to other consultants, clients, industry leaders. So I'm really glad to have you on, to have you share your perspective. And before we jump into that, I think you and I have actually known each other for a handful of years now because we got the chance of working together back when I was in industry. So really excited to have you tell your story.
Yeah, it's great to reconnect. And it's my favorite topic. Change management is my favorite topic. And it's just endlessly interesting. There's just so many wrinkles and situations that, you know, cause us to adapt in this digital transformation journey. So I'm excited to talk about it today.
Hey, well, let's get to it. Can you take a minute and tell everybody about yourself and your current role at nCino?
Sure. Yeah. I'm a 30-year banker. So I grew up on the accounting side of things. I was actually a CPA auditing banks with a public accounting firm. And then I got so interested in the banking side that I joined a bank. And it was during a very acquisitive time for the industry back in the late 80s. And so I ended up in M&A work for about 4 years and started to see how banks not only made money, but how different parts of the bank came together to work together so that it all worked, you know, for the benefit of the shareholder, the customer, et cetera. And so that led me, so I had some CFO roles at some larger banks, and then that led me to some chief operating officer roles at some smaller banks. And at one of those banks, where I was chief operating officer, we were looking for a commercial workflow platform that would allow us to facilitate commercial transactions across the U.S. And it was before the cloud was really cool. It was before people were using the cloud to facilitate stuff. And that's how I stumbled into nCino, because it was a cloud-based Salesforce type platform. And I was one of the first customers of nCino. So that was about 10 years ago, and learned some hard lessons. maybe did a few things right, but it was a struggle to understand, you know, how to have an effective digital transformation, go from paper to something that was fully digital. And so that kind of led me to the path I'm on right now.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. You were one of the first clients of nCino. And when we go back to when we ran into each other, you weren't at nCino yet, right? You were still doing this for yourself.
Okay. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And back then I was implementing nCino for about a $15 billion bank. And we had just done a Salesforce project, and nCino was the next piece as we got the whole organization ramped up on the platform. And I think we were a couple of months into our implementation, and you and your team came in to really help us, not just help to get the executives aligned on what does this mean for the business. And as we were coming together as a new bank after an acquisition and a merger, but how is everybody going to do their job and how do we approach it? So do you Talk to me a little bit about what your business was like back then and what you were doing with most banks.
Yeah, what we discovered was that, so I had the opportunity starting back 10 years ago to talk to a lot of potential customers or customers of nCino who wanted to compare notes about, you know, kind of what went well or challenges and that kind of thing. And as we were comparing notes, there was a pattern that emerged for me that the things that caused customers to be successful in their digital transformation journey, or the things that made them struggle, had nothing to do with the technology. It was all about, are the leaders aligned and prepared for the change that's coming, not only to how they do their job, but to how we're going to facilitate transactions across the company for our customers. And so kind of all the way down the food chain of our, how the work gets done. Are we clear on what's going to happen when we go live? And what I found was that many times executives thought that this digital transformation was going to affect everybody else, but it wasn't going to affect them. And from my own personal experience, I know that was not the case. So About so after talking with literally hundreds of banks, it became clear that there needed to be a focus on these things that don't have anything to do with the technology when you're making this digital transformation journey. So about 5 years ago, I built out a change management program that's, you know, complete with a workshop that allows leaders to come together and have discussions about how this is going to work in their culture, you know, complete with workbooks and homework and all kinds of things. And so that was when you and I met. Was one of the very first experiences we had to try that out. And since then, we've done, you know, over 100 such workshops with leaders around the country, banks large and small, actually across the world. And it's proven very helpful to folks. I think most people say, I wish we had done this sooner. Or it illuminates blind spots that they didn't really think about when they bought software to start this digital journey. There's more to it than software. And that's kind of a blind spot for most executives.
Yeah, and I 100% agree. It's very rarely due to the technology of being a pain point. It's about the team, the culture, kind of expectations, and just the fear of the change or fear of, am I going to be exposed or is this going to replace me? And I find a lot, like if we can get the middle management group to recognize like, hey, we're here to make your job easier. We want to complement the great work your teams are already doing and hopefully allow them to get out of the manual processes and the things that are wasting their time and empower them, enable them to have more impactful conversations, interactions in those client experiences. So getting that middle layer to really buy in on it tends to be like the magic I see happen. But can you talk about some of the approaches that you guys have brought to the table, whether it be a big project, small project, or big bank, small bank? Like, what are some tools and tips for aligning the right people and getting a project not just complete, but helping people get set up for the long-term enablement?
Yeah, that's a great question, JP. And there's actually great wisdom in what you just said. That middle management layer, we do find to be the layer of people that tend to resist this change the most. And it seems to sort of sneak up on you. But that group of people typically were not involved in the buying decision. So they are sort of the last to be bought in. And they were hired to protect the processes that exist at the company. And so when we talk about changing those processes and they weren't part of that buying decision, we should expect them to resist. It's not because they're bad people. It's because they're trying to protect something that they care about, something that they've been hired to do, from something they don't understand. So we have an obligation to explain to them how this is good for the company, the customer, the employees, how it's a better process and all that. So we think of that as not a technology problem, but a leadership obligation to explain to people how their jobs are going to change, why it's good for the company, customer, and shareholder. Yeah, so we go through 9 steps. We think that change management is an actual process that you can go through. It's a series of steps. It's not mysterious. It's actually quite objective and concrete. It starts with making sure that you have a clear purpose statement that that the leadership team agrees to, that they've discussed and had healthy debate around, and they can actually say, yeah, we have created a statement that describes in one sentence or one breath why we're doing this for the benefit of our customers, our shareholders, or our employees, or everybody. So we go through a process to get them to debate that and agree upon that in about 30 or 45 minutes. And usually it reflects words that are part of their mission statement, something that's part of the language that they use internally that would resonate with anyone who would hear it and say, yeah, that's unique to us as a company. Then we talk about what are you going to measure to make sure that you are seeing things that evidence that you are making progress toward that purpose that you described in one sentence. So we try to get it down to less than 5 things that you can measure that are symbolic of success on the digital transformation journey. And I'm an accountant by background, so I kind of think if you don't measure it, it never existed. So we really do emphasize, you know, measuring your progress along the way so you can prove that the hard work is worth it. And whether you're a big company or a small company, it really doesn't matter. Resistance is part of the journey. So we talk about how are you going to manage resistance in your culture, because it's typically unique to that culture. You know who the people are who are going to resist, and you know the distractions and competing priorities that are going to take resources away from the transformation. So we talk about if we can identify those sources of resistance, we should be able to manage them. And we talk about strategies to manage that resistance. Then we talk about leadership alignment. It's really, really important for all the leaders who own the process and have decision-making authority are aligned, not only on the outcomes, but they share responsibility for how this project's going to go and how they're going to make decisions along the way. So we talk about leadership alignment and shared responsibility. And we actually get each leader to make a personal commitment to the success of the transformation. So they verbalize it, write it down, share it with each other so they can hold each other accountable for that. And that becomes pretty important in the journey. We also then talk about the process change, which is the backbone of change management. So understanding how the work is going to change from the way we do it today to the way we do it tomorrow. So that's really important. So we talk about who's going to own the from to sort of mapping of how that process is going to change so we can explain it to people and they can understand it. That also forces the leaders to be accountable to understand it themselves so they can speak to it. Then we talk about testing strategy. Testing is the number two reason why these transformations struggle, because we don't have the right people test the right things. So we identify who are the right people to test and what are the most important things to test before we go live. Training is another thing that we talk about. So what's the comprehensive training strategy we're going to have to make sure that everyone is ready before they go live as much as possible, so that when they start getting those reps, they know where to go for resources and they've got a guide for how to do their job. We talk about a communication plan. That's the eighth thing of the nine things we talk about. We talk about how important it is to make sure that every audience understands how their job's going to change. And we have a method by which we're going to communicate to them in terms of what are those unique messages, how frequently we're going to communicate them, who's going to communicate, what's the method of communication, and make sure that the people that do the communicating own that message before we go live. And then you said something that I love, which is how are we going to sustain success after go live? That's frequently something that's widely overlooked by large and small organizations, is having a construct set up before you go live so that you can make sure that you can sustain success after you go live, because the transformation starts when the project ends. And if you don't have decision makers who have a governance process set up so they can debate the path forward, we find that a lot of times these transformations stagnate. So having that center of excellence or transformation governance group together before you go live is really, really important to make sure you maintain success after you go live. So that's a lot, but that's kind of the way we go through it.
Yeah, those nine steps are great. I actually want to focus in on a couple of them as we continue the conversation. So number one, I love the vision statement, kind of what is it we're doing? What are we accomplishing? What is the solution going to bring to our organization or our clients? We incorporate that a lot into our clients, is whether it's a big project, small project, or we're just trying to take more out of the capabilities. Like, what is this product we're basically implementing for the organization? And not just like Encino, Salesforce, whatever it might be, but what's this capability going to be for my team? And then how's it going to impact our clients, make it really crisp and like really easy to understand, so that way we all have the North Star for what this is going to do for us. I think that's critical. Number two, you talked about it, was measures. Like, what is it we are, do we have any benchmarks of how things are going today? Because in some cases we'll come in and people are like, you know, we don't have great reporting, so anything's better than what we have today. But no, let's really challenge you to, let's dig into some things. And what one thing I use with a couple clients implementing Encino and Salesforce together is, well, one of our goals is to improve our sales, our commercial sales efficiency, our deal cycle times. And it's like, well, we don't have great numbers because we don't have a tool today to actually track how long is it in a stage, how long is it in that queue, what's the end-to-end cycle from the time we gather the documentation to get it to a closed loan. I mean, sometimes we'll have some rough numbers, but sometimes challenging everyone to look at it and say, hey, well, how many of your salespeople are hitting goal today? And can we use that as a measure to say, hey, 50% hit goal on the last year over year, last 3 years. So if we can take that from 50 to 75%, that would be a huge lift, and we can start to track towards that. So I think the measures is something that is always a real big pain point for everybody. Can you talk a little bit about how you've helped establish some key benchmarks, not just from the product perspective, but even just for organizations, big and small, commercial, business banking, even into the retail banking space? It's all a little bit different, but what are some of the tools you've used to help establish those?
Yeah, what we do is, and we found this to work, is we get the leaders together and we say, okay, what do you talk about all the time? What's important to you? Like you said, I mean, are the salespeople hitting their goals? Are we You know, so I will tell you the number one word that comes up when we brainstorm, what do we want to measure in terms of indicative measures of success? The word efficiency comes up all the time. And I say, well, that's a really big word. It can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. And depending on what you're implementing, whether it's a deposit solution or a commercial loan or retail loan or treasury, it can mean lots of different things. So we take that word and we say, okay, what does that actually mean? So when you say that, what does it mean? Because if you're a CFO, what it might mean is we're going to cut costs. We're going to eliminate jobs. For somebody else, it might mean, no, we don't want to eliminate jobs. We want to do more with the people we have. We want to have more volume, you know, kind of per person or whatever. And for other folks, it could be, we want to have faster cycle time from, say, approval to close. And so we drill down on exactly what that means. And then if we say, okay, efficiency means faster, you know, cycle time, we'll say from what to what. And so we get really discreet around what it is we're going to measure. And like you said, it's not uncommon to not have a benchmark pre-go live, but we encourage everyone, if at all possible, once you identify what those very small handful of measures are, identify what it is today before you go live. So measure it before you go live, and then measure it after you go live every, you know, 3-6 months, so that you can demonstrate you're making progress. And that becomes something that your governance team should be looking at and talking about. What's the story we're going to publish when we publish these metrics? So not only what's the data, but what's it telling us? And what does that mean in terms of how we should respond or do more of or do something different, that kind of thing. So it's not enough to measure it. You got to figure out how it's going to affect your path forward. When I was an executive sponsor of a couple of implementations, one of the key metrics we looked at was that time from approval to close, because we used to argue about it all the time from a commercial lending perspective. And so we talked about it all the time, and I went to my loan operations person and I said, hey, what is our average time from approval to close? And she said, we don't know. I said, what do you mean we don't know? She said, well, we don't actually measure it. I said, okay, well, we know the date that every deal got closed. She said, yeah, every date, the date the deal got approved. She said, yep. And I said, we know the date every deal got closed. She said, yep. I said, okay, well, just go back for the last 6 months and every deal that closed, let's see what those dates were and get an average. And she did. And she came back and she said, the average time is 52 days from approval to close. Said, okay, well, let's set a goal that we're going to cut that by a third after we go live. And I didn't know if we could achieve that or not, but turns out we achieved that in 6 months after we went live. And that one metric resonated with everyone, because for our CFO, you know, we were getting deals closed sooner, which meant interest income hit the book sooner. For our operations folks and for our sales folks, it meant that deals got done quicker. Loan officers got paid sooner. Customers got their money sooner. And everyone could kind of see that we were faster, we were better, we were more efficient. And so it was one metric that resonated with everybody. We like to try to find those kind of symbolic metrics that have legs with lots of different audiences. And so that was an example that worked for me. And those speed kind of metrics that you mentioned work for a lot of customers too.
Well, and speaking of that example, so I want to dissect that a little bit. So you went to this person and asked them to pull this up for you. And I'm guessing they didn't have this readily available, because they probably were getting this request through Outlook, or then they were taking it from Outlook and putting it in an Excel sheet. And so just the effort of them probably pulling together that it takes 52 days probably took them, what, a week, two weeks maybe?
Yeah, it took about a week. Right. Yeah. You had to have somebody go to a corner, get a spreadsheet, look up all those dates, put them in, you know, do the average, get it checked by somebody, and then, you know, yeah, exactly right.
So not only did you establish that, hey, this is the metric, at least we think, and now you can communicate that we're going to improve on this metric, but then going forward, you've just set the foundation that one metric's probably got 4 or 5 other metrics that you can leverage now to say, hey, now I can report on this in seconds. Hey, now I can get involved in this if I see something taking longer, and I can take that maybe bottlenecked or blocked deal and push that forward, or at least get involved and make a bigger impact on that cycle and give people more tools to better manage their day-to-day and be proactive versus probably what you were doing at the time, was everybody was very reactive to this and finding out, oh, 30 days later, oh, our cycle times are 60, 70 days instead. So I just find it like once you can get one thing created, like it starts to branch off into different personas within the bank. And then all of a sudden now you've got a whole library of metrics that you can start to measure that are going to mean a lot to different groups.
Yeah, and they drive the outcome that you're looking for. So what I did not tell you is that of that average 52 days, one deal in that list was 125 days. And there was another deal that was less than 30 days. And so it begs the question, why was that deal that took so long? Why did it take so long? Why did the deal that went so fast go so fast? And what can we do to replicate the fast one and eliminate the roadblocks for the slow one? And so that's the kind of conversations that you can have real time when you have a tool like nCino, and you can identify those immediately. You don't have to have somebody go in a corner for a week and try to build a spreadsheet, but it's there real time. And you can, you know, talk about what are the best practices that led to this really fast deal, and what are the ways, is it training? Is it something about our process that's causing us to bog down? What is it? But you can diagnose it real time and have really useful conversations that are collaborative across teams in order to get to solutions that are good for everybody. So without that data, though, it's exhausting to try to figure it out. And frankly, it usually never happens.
And going right back to what you said before was efficiency. What does efficiency mean when a bank says, I'm looking to be more efficient? And I think this is something that starts to branch off into so many other efficiencies that sometimes are harder to measure and put monetary value to. But once you start to establish this, like there's a good story to tell to say, hey, this now takes, instead of 3 weeks of you wanting to, 2 to 3 weeks of you wanting to know how long is this deal cycle taking or what's our average deal cycle, I can give you that in minutes. I can tell you exactly what types of products are taking longer, which teams are taking longer, or who's our most efficient. Like we can establish new best practices. We can actually onboard people new to the organization if we're scaling. So I just find that efficiency term, once you have the tool, there's so many ways you can start to measure the value and the impact. It's just, you got to put some measures together and then start to think about what does this mean for us from an organization value perspective.
Yeah, JP, it's really important for the leadership team to have an intentional conversation around what does this mean for us. I was in a change management workshop with a bank, and the CEO and the CFO were both in the workshop. And when this came up, their biggest objective was efficiency. I said, okay, what does that mean? For some people, it could mean, you know, we're going to do more with the same people we got. For some people, it could mean speed. For some, it could mean, you know, we're going to cut jobs. And the CEO went right to that. And he's like, no, we're not eliminating any jobs. The CFO said, oh, that's in our business plan. Yeah, we're absolutely going to cut jobs. So the leadership team themselves was not even on the same page about what efficiency meant. And so there's no way they could communicate that consistently to their team. So just being intentional about these change management conversations, we find to be very important, because in the normal course, as a leadership team, we typically don't sit down and really talk about how are we going to communicate this, not only to our teams, but to our shareholders, and what is it we're trying to achieve? And let's just take a moment and talk about that. So that the value of these conversations is bigger than just, how do we make this project more efficient? It really leads to some very interesting dialogue across the leadership team around, what's our intention with our company for this digital transformation?
Well, and going back to your 9 keys to kind of successful programs, I think the other one is, hey, this project or this whole approach is probably setting us up for a new way of working. And when we're done and we get live with this first release, like we're not done. Don't kid yourselves. Like we're just getting started if this is really going to make the impact you want it to. So can you talk a little bit about the approach to getting everyone enabled to not only get the project done successfully, but really put people in the right places to keep pushing the transformation forward and communicating out the success of the program?
Yeah, it's really important, not only for the leadership team to be aligned, but within that, you need to have a face for the project. You need to have someone who is sponsoring that effort, who is driving it forward. So if it's everybody's job, it's nobody's job. So we say it's really important to have a strong executive sponsor who's empowered to make decisions, who is visible across the company, who's credible. And that's not just true during the project, it's especially true post-go live. So you got to have that clear executive sponsor. You need to have an intention that the processes are going to continue to change post-go live and communicate that to your users. And And JP, we find that most users don't believe that. That's an area where people don't trust that the process is going to continue to change post-go live on a frequent basis. Because in their experience at most banks, once we put technology or a new process in, it just stays there for 5 years, 10 years. So this idea that we have the opportunity to continually evolve and change and improve our process based on user feedback or new features, functionality based on customer feedback is a really new concept, which is why you need to have this governance group post-go live that is prioritizing, making decisions about what comes first, second, third, and then how we're going to test it, communicate it, train it, and then push it into production. It's bigger than just the systems, software side of this. It's really the effectiveness of this evolutionary transformation happens in how you have a good communication strategy, testing strategy, training strategy, so that you can have this continual loop of new ways of operating. Never stops.
Well, I think the one thing you said there too is the lack of trust of continuous improvement and that this is going to keep going is really important to make sure you start to prove that. As soon as you get into that initial launch and support of, hey, my users are now live, I need to be very reactive and quick to respond and quick to keep enabling. I see some clients offer to have like office hours. They post little quick hit videos of here's how to do this, here's how to do that. Really empowering your SMEs to kind of keep pushing people forward and champion where we're going. And then if you can come out within the first 4 or 6 weeks with, hey, here's a couple more features we just released and we're going to start to publish that roadmap and release notes of what we did and why we did it, you start to get people championing it. But one thing I want to talk about a little bit is something you said when we first worked together. Now, we were in a room with, I think, 30 or 40 key stakeholders around our nCino and Salesforce program. And you used the phrase burn the boats. And it really resonated with me that, hey, we're not going backwards. Like, we're only going forwards. And as soon as we can kind of let everybody know that there should be no consideration that you're going back to the old ways of doing things, that really starts to push people forward. So can you tell me more about that phrase or your mantra and why you use it?
We use this all the time. The analogy goes back to Cortez when he came to the New World in 1512. He landed at Veracruz, and if you can imagine that journey from Spain to Central America, it was an arduous, terrible journey. His sailors didn't want to be there. They didn't want to move forward. They didn't want to colonize anything. They just wanted to go back home to Spain. So what he did was, after they unloaded the ships onto the beach, he sent a couple of rowboats out to the larger ships, and in the middle of the night, they set those ships ablaze. So you can imagine, in the dark of night, the night sky is just lit up with these ships burning. And he sent a very clear message in that moment to his sailors that we're not going back to Spain. We're going to do what we came to do. There is no going back. So we like to tell our customers that digital transformation is the same way. You have to be deeply committed to this transformation. You have to turn off all the old systems and processes. You can't give people an option to continue doing things the old way, or you will create great dysfunction across your team, especially in your operations group, who's having to manage deals that are coming in from lots of different sources. So we say, turn off all the old systems and processes, even Excel, even Word, all those things that people use as crutches to not use the new process and get those efficiencies that you're looking for. And when you do that, you find that people get more reps. And the more reps they get, the faster they get. And the faster they get, the more you start to see that return on investment, those efficiencies that you're looking for. But if you don't do that, if you don't burn the boats, then you have all kinds of exception processes and you have workarounds, and those are a killer in terms of getting the efficiency for digital transformation. So we tell people that's the number one reason why these digital transformations fail is you don't burn the boats. You've got to burn the boats, the rowboats, the canoes, any vestiges of the old system, so that you can make sure that you're fully committed to this new process. And by the way, that's not a technology thing. That's a leadership commitment. So we talk about this early when the project starts, so that if the leaders are aligned, that when we go live, we are not going to allow people to use the old processes anymore. You immediately start out with a much higher probability of success than if you equivocate on that, or you really don't have leaders aligned on that one point. Early on, it can lead to lots of issues and problems later.
Yeah, and I have stolen that since you first said it to us. I use it in some of our engagements where clients are like, hey, how do we make sure we have a successful go live? I'm like, well, I was once told, burn the boats. Make sure your leadership and your middle management teams understand that you there's only one way forward. And if you're going to submit something using the old way, it's going to be ignored or it's going to get pushed back. And you gotta adopt it and you gotta embrace it. And it's gonna be challenging potentially for some people to adopt the new way. But if we're really going to make it successful, you have to force the buy-in and start to push people forward.
JP, we have customers who use that burn the boats analogy as part of their go live celebration. On the day they go live, we have one customer had like a pirate party. So everybody dressed up like a pirate and they had this big burn the boats cake in the middle of the common area. And they made this, it was a big deal. You know, they gave away doubloons and all kinds of stuff. So you can have fun with it, but it's really important to message that in a very clear way to all users that we are from this day forward, we are not going to use the old process and we're not going to even accept transactions that use that old process. That is the number one reason why these transformations struggle or fail.
Well, Greg, I appreciate you coming on. It's been great to reconnect and talk about some of the old times working together and hear about what you've been doing since then. Before I let you go, I got one more question. We like to ask all of our guests to share a fun fact about yourself that not many people know. It could be an accomplishment, a talent, a fun, or almost unbelievable story. So what do you have for us today?
Well, it may not be the best story you ever had, and it may not be the most exciting thing, but I'm a certified barbecue judge. So I go around the country and I judge barbecue competitions, and I love it. I learn it's an endless well of learning about how to cook a better barbecue and to experience good cooking. I'm a people watcher, so there's endless people watching at these barbecue competitions. So that's something that I do on the weekends, and it's a hobby. Some people call it a sport. I'm not sure it's a sport, but it is a fun thing to do, and I love it. So that's a little unusual thing.
How far around do you travel, and can you, without getting in trouble, can you say which region has the best barbecue?
Oh, well, they say that the region that you believe has the best barbecue is the region where you grew up. So I grew up in Louisiana, and so Texas barbecue is more what I like, but it depends on where you grew up. You know, South Carolina's mustard based, North Carolina's vinegar based, Memphis is molasses based, Texas is tomato based. But so I'm more the Texas kind of barbecue, but that's just because of my heritage. And I could judge competitions all over the world, but I typically stay within 200 or 300 miles of where I live. So, but it's a fun hobby.
Awesome. Well, that's a great story. And next time I come out to Encino, maybe we'll have to get some barbecue together. So you take me out. Awesome.
Love that. All right.
Well, thanks for joining us, Greg. And thank you all for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and leave a review. To learn more about Silverline, you can subscribe to the Silverline blog at silverlinecrm.com or follow on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook at SilverlineCRM, one word. Thanks again for joining us today.